So I'm here all the way through Thursday, leaving early Friday morning. So if you're, oh, sorry. So if you're interested in chatting anytime, just come find me. I'm in 268. I'm going to talk about some relatively recent work. Here's the title. Let me start by just thanking my two collaborators. So most of what I'll talk about today is with Andrew Essen, who was here a month ago, had a sort of overly eventful visit, but I can tell you that he's fine now. everything's back to normal. So he's a postdoc with us in Boulder, and he's going to be moving to Caltech to start another postdoc position. And some of the newer work in progress toward the end of the talk is with a student of mine in Boulder, Hao Sung. Okay. Thanks to the Packard Foundation also for paying the bills. So there are kind of two kind of main sets of themes or questions that are behind this work, sort of motivating this work. So one is a kind of pretty big question. What is a quantum phase of matter? How do we think about quantum phases of matter? How do we distinguish them? How do we understand their properties? How do we probe them? What should we probe? And maybe how do we classify them? What are the possibilities? And there's another kind of more specific but related question, which is kind of trying to get a better understanding of this phenomenon of quantum number fractionalization, and in particular in two dimensions. And so you'll see that there are questions that come up, I'll be more specific in a minute, sort of how to think about, are there different kinds of quantum number fractionalization? How do we understand if two kinds of fractionalization are different or the same? Are there observable consequences of that? So kind of the goal here is to try to better answer some of these questions by developing classifications, or partial classifications at least, of certain kinds of objects. So I'll be more specific about that in a minute. I told Xiaogang I wasn't going to say this here because I didn't think I had to, but maybe I'll say it anyway. So for me, classification, so when you classify something, you get a list, right? And the goal is not really the list, right? The goal is what are you going to do with the list? So really, for me, the list itself maybe is not a very practical thing. But the question of what you do with the list after you get it is, I think, really a very practical question, right? Because once you have a list of different kinds of quantum phases of some particular type, then you know what it is that you might want to distinguish or detect. If you're trying to understand, say, in an experiment or in a numerical simulation, what kind of quantum phase of matter you have, right? And if you don't understand the possibilities, it's sort of hard to know what to calculate or what to measure, okay? So at least in the long run, these are pretty practical considerations, I think, even though it may not look like it in the short run. Okay, so here's some outline. I'll start with some motivation, which for this audience, I'm going to keep rather brief, and then I'll get right to the details of our work. So I'm going to talk about some kind of symmetry classification of topologically ordered phases. So first, I'll explain our classification for symmetry excluding point group operations, because when you have point group operations, things get a little more tricky. Then I'll tell you how things work in general. The sort of newer part at the end has to do with trying to find explicit realizations of some of these symmetry classes in microscopic models. Okay. So one of the themes of my talk, I told you, is thinking about quantum phases of matter, right? So as condensed matter physicists, one of our goals, we could say, is to classify all phases of matter, and that's pretty ambitious. Another goal, more personal goal, is to work on problems that I personally have a chance of actually solving or at least contributing to. So for me, these two goals are conflicting. That might not be true for everybody, okay? This is a personal statement, but for me, these two goals are in conflict. So you have to resolve that some way. And so usually the way you resolve this is to work on a simpler problem. And so you might say that sort of a still very difficult problem, but not, you know, neither too easy nor too difficult problem that kind of resolves these goals is to try to think about classification of phases with an energy gap. Okay, so this is still probably very hard to solve in general, but it's possible to make some progress, and people are making lots of progress on this question these days. Okay, so let's talk about gapped quantum states of matter. Let me say that throughout the talk, I'm going to focus on local bosonic models. So I mean sort of generalized spin models with some finite range interactions. Okay, so just to simplify the discussion, I'm going to focus on this class of models. So one way to organize our thinking about gap states of matter is to first ask what we know about the possibilities if there's no symmetry at all. Okay, so no lattice symmetry, no time reversal, spin rotation, nothing like that. So in one dimension, in these conditions, we know there's just one trivial phase. Okay, so there's not much interesting that happens. In two dimensions, things get more interesting. So you can have topologically ordered states with anyons, okay, like in fractional quantum Hall effect or various quantum spin liquid states. It's also possible to have this is only recently appreciated, to have a state in two dimensions with with no topological order, no anyons, and no ground state degeneracy on a non-trivial manifold, but with chiral edge modes. And so this is like a bosonic version of integer quantum Hall effect. It has a quantized thermal Hall conductance, like integer quantum Hall effect. Okay, so maybe there are more. I don't want to try to make any statement about completeness here. And similarly, in three dimensions, there are sort of similar possibilities. Okay, in this talk, I'm going to focus on two dimensions, though. That's some rough list of what can happen if there's no symmetry, but I want to focus on what happens if there is some global symmetry present. Okay, so one way to think about this is to say, well, suppose I have some symmetry group G, and I have a bunch of phases which are all distinct, but then I can imagine that I weakly break all the symmetries in the problem. Okay, so I get back to the no symmetry case, and when I do that, I have to get back to one of these possibilities. Okay, and you can imagine that you can have a collection of phases which all go into the same no symmetry phase under this symmetry breaking. Okay, right. They might go into different phases, but let's consider a bunch of phases that all go into the same no symmetry phase under breaking of all symmetry. So for a fixed phase, for a fixed no symmetry phase and a fixed symmetry group G, what we can say is that all these phases are distinct symmetry enrichments of this no symmetry phase, okay, that they go into when you break all the symmetry. Okay, so that's just a way of kind of organizing our thinking about this problem. Okay, so there are different, so if you want to study these symmetry enriched phases, one thing you can specify is to first say what no symmetry phase are you going to look at. So one thing that you might imagine trying to do to start with is say, well, suppose this is the trivial phase, okay? Something that's adiabatically connected to just a product state. So that's what gives you symmetry protected topological phases, right? So these phases, you could define them as symmetry enrichments of the trivial state. Okay? They become trivial when you break all symmetry. And there are some classic examples of these. So one is the Haldane phase of the spin one chain. A more recent one that really set off a lot of the recent activity in this field are Z2 topological band insulators in two and three dimensions. Of course, these occur in fermion systems. I mostly said I'm focusing on boson models, but I have to mention this example. So recently, there are many more examples and also a still developing systematic understanding of these SPT phases. And there's such an explosion of work on this topic that I didn't even try to compile a list of references, okay? Especially since it's not the main focus of my talk. So the only thing I really want to mention, just to make one point, is that in terms of physical properties, these SPT states are characterized, you take, say, this 2D system, and you cut it, and you make an edge. And it has some non-trivial, in this case, edge states. And in this particular case, these would be edge states that are gapless. They're required to be gapless or spontaneously break whatever symmetry you started with. Okay. And this really makes sense, or it's at least it's particularly robust if you're talking about internal symmetry, things like time reversal symmetry or spin rotation symmetry, symmetries that can be preserved when you cut the system and make a generic edge. Okay. So for that reason, most of the work on SPT phases focuses on internal symmetries, and there's a good physical reason for that. Okay. Generally, people don't consider spatial symmetries, like point group or space group. There is some recent work along those lines too, but SPT states that require spatial symmetries to protect them are quite a bit less robust than SPT states, which involve only some internal symmetries. Okay, so for SPT states, there's a good reason to focus completely on internal symmetry. Okay, so there's another kind of class of symmetry enrichments that one can talk about. So you could say, well, why start with the trivial phase? Why don't I start with some topologically ordered phase? Okay, so if you start with some fixed topologically ordered phase and then you have some symmetry, that's what people mean by an SET phase, symmetry enriched topological phase. Okay, so what can I say about SET phases? Well, there are lots of examples of these phases in models, and in the case of fractional quantum Hall effect, also in experiments, but not just fractional quantum Hall effect. There are a lot of models that exhibit various kinds of spin liquid phases, for example, which are in this class. Okay, so there are a lot of examples in models. Like for SPT phases, but unlike for SPT phases, the systematic understanding of classifying and distinguishing SET phases is rather less developed. Okay, although that's changing, and there are a lot of recent works really, so all of these are within the last year, and there is some prior work here as well, so this is just mentioning some of the recent ones, but there's kind of been an explosion of work, much of it just in the last few months, actually. And the work I'm telling you about is in here somewhere. Okay. So one point I want to make, I said that for SPT phases, it's natural to focus on internal symmetry. For SET phases, there's really no reason to do that. Well, you could do that, maybe for simplicity, but in SET phases, you have anyon excitations in the bulk. And so the bulk properties are also interesting and non-trivial, and there are interesting physically observable consequences in the bulk. And so that means that you don't necessarily have to make an edge to have some interesting physical consequence. And so therefore, it's more important to think about space group symmetry if you're thinking about SET phases. Okay. And probably the one thing that most distinguishes our work from these other works is that we've really been kind of focused on thinking about the role of space group symmetry in SET phases. Although space group symmetry is more complicated, and so there's a price to pay for doing that. Okay. All right. So how to get a handle on this? Well, this kind of comes to the second set of questions I told you I was interested in. So one thing that we know occurs in a lot of SET phases from many familiar examples is this phenomenon of quantum number fractionalization. Okay, so in quantum Hall states, we know that electrons can split into fractionally charged Laughlin quasiparticles, or we can have a system of spins on some lattice where you can create free spin a half excitations, which carry the spin of the electron and not the charge. So they're also, think of them as fractionalized. Okay, so these are some familiar examples of quantum number fractionalization. But you can start to ask questions, is there a notion of distinct types of quantum number fractionalization? Okay, and maybe if there is, then there's some way to classify different kinds of quantum number fractionalization. And that would be useful if you can use it to distinguish phases. So maybe if you have phase A and phase B that have sort of different kinds of fractional quantum numbers in some robust sense, and if you knew that, you could say with confidence that phase A and phase B have to be distinct phases of matter, maybe only if you preserve symmetry, though, right? Okay, so that's So that's a set of questions that we can ask, okay? So in order to start answering those questions, it's helpful to get a bit more specific, okay? And so the approach we took is to say, well, let's focus on a particular type of topological order in two dimensions, okay? One of the simplest ones, maybe the simplest one, at least in some sense. So we said, well, let's focus on gapped Z2 spin liquids. So what does it mean to have a gapped Z2 spin liquid? So really all it means is that we have a local bosonic model with Z2 topological order, which I'll define in a second, and no spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay, it's helpful to imagine that there's no spontaneous symmetry breaking just to take that out of the discussion and kind of simplify everything. Okay, so what's Z2 topological order? Well, one way to define it is in terms of some characteristic anions or anions or anion types. Okay, so there are four of them. There are two which are bosons. Their self-statistics is bosonic. So if I have an E and an M, I exchange an E with an E. I get no statistical phase. Same thing for an M. There's another one which is a fermion, I'll call epsilon. So that has fermionic self-statistics. And there's also a trivial particle or identity particle, which is not really an anion. Okay. So that has also has trivial bosonic statistics. Okay. Question.
But just to clarify, just to ask. So is the no spontaneous symmetry breaking, is that associated with the fact that the spin liquid is gapped?
No. So, well, it would be if you're talking about continuous symmetry. You can have gapless Z2 spin liquids which preserve all symmetries. So the low energy theory would be something like deconfined Z2 gauge theory coupled to some massless fermions with, say, massless Dirac points. So there are examples of states like that. The extent to which you can say that those have, there is a sense in which states like that can be said to have topological order, but it's a weaker sense than the gapped states. So if you want to be able to talk about the properties of a state in terms of some anion excitations and their braiding properties and fusion properties, you really need to have a gapped state. And some of that may survive if you have a gapless state with some similar properties, but it becomes a lot more complicated. So there are certain properties like, for example, topological ground state degeneracy, which in a sense you can talk about surviving when you have a gapless state. But it all becomes a lot more delicate. So I want to kind of take that out of the discussion. Right. Right. So, I mean, the bottom line is that kind of in general, gapless states are more complicated. Especially outside of 1+1 dimensions, classifying gapless states is a very hard problem. Okay. So the point is that so all of these excitations, right, these are some anion excitations, they're all gapped. Okay. They have this self-statistics. E, M, epsilon, and 1 are just labels for them. They satisfy some fusion rules. So for example, if I bring two E's close together, I can think of the region surrounding those two E's as containing two E's, or I can think of it as containing a single identity particle. That's the meaning of this fusion rule, E cross E equals 1. Similarly, if I fuse, say, an E with an M, then I get an epsilon. And if I fuse an M with an epsilon, I get an E, and so on. Okay. So in addition to self-statistics, there's also mutual statistics. So if I bring any anion in this theory around any distinct type of anion, so if I bring an E all the way around an M, I pick up a statistical phase of -1, theta equals pi. Okay, and that's true for any pair of distinct anions. All right. One other quick thing I can say about this theory is that if you're familiar with Z2 gauge theory or Ising gauge theory, this theory is realized in the deconfined phase of an Ising gauge theory. Okay, it's just this language is somewhat more abstract than as compared to that. That's a concrete microscopic realization of this theory. This is this is really an abstraction of some kind of essential or basic information. Okay, we're talking about the theory in terms of its excitations. So I'll come back to this in a little bit more. But first, let me say, you know, first of all, why pick this example? So we're picking some particular topological order. Why this one and not some other one? Well, one reason is just that it's really simple. Okay, it's perhaps the simplest topological order that there is in two dimensions. Okay, and another example is that there's actually some serious motivation to study this particular example. Okay, so there's evidence, recent evidence, that gapped Z2 spin liquids may actually occur in rather simple, sort of almost realistic spin a half Heisenberg antiferromagnets on these two lattices. Okay, so square lattice with some diagonal exchange, or a Kagame lattice with the nearest neighbor exchange. Okay, so then there are sort of more practical questions that come up, things like, okay, if you have a Z2 spin liquid in these models and it has some kind of quantum number fractionalization, can you tell? Can you find some direct evidence? One thing we know is that in the presence of symmetry, there are many different kinds of Z2 spin liquids. And if you don't know that already, you'll find out about that in the later part of the talk. So there's a question, can we tell which Z2 spin liquids occur? Okay, so I won't be able to answer these questions in this talk, but I'd like to be able to answer these kind of questions, hopefully not in the not too distant future. Okay. All right, so focusing on this particular kind of topological order, the idea is to develop what I would call a symmetry classification. Okay, so it's not, the full problem is to say, what are, for a given symmetry group and for this fixed Z2 topological order, list for me all the different symmetry enriched phases that are possible. Okay, that's a harder question. I don't know how to answer that question. A simpler question, which I do know how to answer, is I know how to mostly answer, for this fixed Z2 topological order, what are the distinct ways in which symmetry can act on the topological degrees of freedom? Okay, and this essentially amounts to understanding different kinds of quantum number fractionalization. Okay. So the idea is that there will be a bunch of symmetry classes corresponding to different actions of symmetry. And in each class, there could be a number of phases that are distinct from one another for some other reasons, which don't have to do with the symmetry action. Okay. So understanding the distinct possibilities within each class, and in some special cases, there's now from other people's work some understanding of what these possibilities are, actually, but I don't think I'll have time to mention it. But for the most part, understanding what these distinct possibilities are within each class is a problem for our future work. Okay. So we have symmetry classes. They're basically given by specifying some types of fractionalization. One thing that I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, is that there are other symmetry classes which are not of this type. Okay, because the other kind of thing that can happen, which I'm going to exclude as a possibility just for simplicity, is that it's possible for symmetry to take one type of anyon and turn it into another type of anyon. So some symmetry operations can permute the anyon types. And that's kind of distinct from having fractional quantum numbers. Okay. You know, one could develop a full symmetry classification, including that possibility too, but I'm just going to exclude it for this talk. There will be enough to talk about already without that. Okay.
Yeah. Symmetry class. I mean, so the within a symmetry class, there's also distinct phase.
Yeah, or there can be.
Okay. So is it some kind of kind of cross grain?
Yeah. So it's a it's kind of you could view it as a partial classification, okay. Right? So it's a collection of phases that all share a certain set of universal properties. Okay. Such that if you have a phase in one class and a phase in another class, you know they have to be different. But if you have a state in one class and some other state in the same class, they may or may not be different. Yeah. Okay. So let me just mention there is some prior work on these kind of questions. I don't have time to get into a detailed discussion of kind of how our work differs from all of these. Okay. Let me just mention that sort of crucial inspiration for this work is Shaogang's projective symmetry group classification. Just to say one sentence about that, the main way in which, probably the most important way in which our work goes beyond this kind of classification is that this, at least in its original formulation, is really a mean field classification, right? But our classification goes beyond mean field theory. And it's also tied to a certain set of particular formalisms, slave particle or parton formalism. But we don't need to talk about slave particles or partons. The other thing that I want to mention is in Appendix F, that's the last one. There's no Appendix G of Kataev's 2006 Annals of Physics paper. There are some results there, kind of just assertive, that have a lot of overlap with ours, at least to the extent that I understand what's contained within this appendix. Okay. So you can take a look there. And maybe you may understand more of it than I do. Okay. I had to do this work first in order to understand what's contained in the appendix. Okay. So let me start to get into details a little bit. Let me first talk about a simple example which doesn't really require. So I think this example is something that anybody could have understood quite a while ago. It doesn't really require any machinery of any sort to explain. So let's think about the case where we have just spin rotation symmetry, just to get a flavor of what we want to do. Okay. So and let's think about an E particle, so one of our anion types. So basically what we need to do is assign some kind of a spin quantum number to an E particle. Well, we know how to do that because we know the irreducible representations of SO3 spin rotation symmetry. And so an E particle could be a singlet, spin a half, spin one, and so on. But what we quickly realize is that there are always going to be spin one excitations in the spectrum which are not anions, okay, just spin flips. So those are always going to be there. They're basically magnons. So if I have a spin a half E particle in the spectrum, I can always fuse it with a spin one magnon and get a spin three halves E particle, okay? And so what this tells you is that the only thing that matters, really, from the point of view of what states are in the spectrum, is whether the E particle has integer spin or half-odd integer spin. So you want to look at the spin mod 1 of the E particle. Okay. And so that would give you what you might call two kind of fractionalization classes for the E particle, two ways to have a fractional spin quantum number. Well, one of them is not really fractional. If it has integer spin, there's nothing fractional about that. But there are two classes. Okay, and one lesson you can draw from this, which is a sort of more general lesson that'll be useful in a second, is that this tells you that what you don't want to do is just classify by irreducible but maybe projective representations of the symmetry group, right? So the half-odd integer spins, they're projective representations. You don't just want to classify by ereps because, of course, well, spin a half and spin three halves are different ereps, but if this is in the spectrum, so will this be. Okay. So anyway, there are these two different fractionalization classes. So the E particle can be spin a half or spin zero mod one. And then you have to do the same thing for M particles and epsilon particles. And once you specify this for E and M, remember that an epsilon you can think of as just a bound state of E and M. So this column follows by fusion rules. Okay. So you have to specify this twice. And so naively, you would say, well, I have four symmetry classes then. But actually, these two rows are the same. And the reason is that you can relabel E and M. There's no difference between E and M in the topological structure. If somebody hands you a theory of this type, you can choose to call one of those particles E and the other one M. And once you make that choice, you have to stick with it. But it's an arbitrary choice that you can make at the beginning. Okay, so there are really three symmetry classes in this case. Okay, fine. So that example is pretty simple. So now I need to tell you a little bit more about this Z2 topological order, kind of general features of any abelian topologically ordered theory that allow us to develop a sort of more complete symmetry classification. Yeah.
So for your simple example, what is the trivial boson?
The one particle. Well, that always is integer spin, right? So that's actually by assumption, right? So if you make a model, right? So that's sort of an assumption about what constitutes a physically reasonable model. So any spin model made out of electrons or atoms or anything, you know, it will always be true that all of the states in the spectrum will just be integer spin. Now, there's one subtlety. You could say, what if I have an odd number of spin a halves? But you could always double the size of the system and get an even number of spin a halves. You could always say, just for simplicity, I'm going to insist on approaching the thermodynamic limit always taking an even number of spin a halves. So that's a little bit of a complication, but it's not an essential one. So you can always assume that all of the many-body wave functions have integer spin. And that means that the one particle, any one particle, always has to have integer spin.
So one more naive question. Mm-hmm. So for this, you are not assuming anything about which one is coherent excitations or not, right? So you just explore all the possibilities, right?
Right. I see. Yeah. So you're saying something like, So to reinterpret your question, I think you're probably saying something like, you know, I'm telling you that an epsilon is a bound state of an E and an M, but energetically that might not really be true. I could make an epsilon and it might decay into an E and an M. Yeah, so that's absolutely true. Because that question about whether you actually have binding of an E and an M in the spectrum or not, that's a non-universal question. You can go from one, you know, so you can tune some parameter and change that in the spectrum without crossing a phase transition. Yeah. Yeah, good, thanks. Okay. So, So an important feature of this theory, which is sort of, it's a little bit more detailed explanation of what it means to have these particle types, is for every particle type, there's associated with it a superselection sector. So what do these superselection sectors mean? Okay, so let's look at this one. So there's an E superselection sector. So let me take an E particle and draw a box around it. Okay, so this is some region of space in the 2D plane. I have a single E particle. And what I say is that the region inside this box is a state in the E superselection sector. So a little bit more generally, what I'm allowed to do is act within this box with any local operators that I like. So I could move this E particle around. I could dress it in various ways. And I could also do things like creating pairs of other E particles, or I could even create a pair of M particles inside. Okay? Because an important point is that part of the definition of the theory really is that you can't create any of these non-trivial anions locally. Okay. What you can do, though, is you can create any one particle excitations locally. And so you could create a pair of E's and then separate them, or pairs of M's and then separate them. But you can't just make a single isolated E by acting with a local operator. Okay. So as long as you act within this box just with local operators, you're not going to change the anion content within the box. And so that's what it means for this region within the box to be a state in the E superselection sector. Okay. All right. So that's a notion which is we can say it's closed under the action of local operators. Okay. So that's the first point. Another point which kind of comes along with that, you can ask, well, how do I move an E particle? Or how do I create a pair of E particles, right? You can't, if you want to create a pair of E particles, one here and one here, you can't do that with a local operator here and here. You have to act with some kind of a string that connects the two, right? Because otherwise that would contradict what I just said, that you can't create one locally, okay? So there will be string operators, one for each particle type, okay? Where, for example, if you have a state, if you want to create a state like this, you would act with some operator which does something in this region, and is connected by some string. Okay, the position of the string itself, once you've acted on the ground state, is not observable. Okay, right. But it would be, it is observable if you do some kind of a non-local measurement, if you encircle one of these E particles. Okay. Okay, so these particles are, you can think of them as being connected by some strings. If I have a particle here and I want to move it here, I can act with a string operator and do that. And I may have to also do something locally on the ends in order to accomplish that motion. Okay, so there are different types of strings. There are E strings and M strings. Epsilon strings, because of the fusion rule, you can just think of as an E string next to an M string. And E strings and M strings anti-commute if you cross one through another. And that just comes from the mutual statistics between E's and M's. Okay. So from this, so this gives some algebra of string operators. And if you think about the algebra of non-contractible loops of string on, say, a torus, you can see that gives you this sort of, for those of you who know this theory, familiar fourfold ground state degeneracy on a torus. Okay. But that I don't need to get into too much. It's a bit of an aside. for what I want to focus on. Okay, so with that aside, I talked about the case of spin rotation symmetry. Let me talk about the case where I have some discrete translation symmetry. So I have some two-dimensional lattice with translation symmetry generated by Tx and Ty, okay, and acting on any many-body wave function, Tx and Ty commute. All right, so what that means is that this has to hold for all physical states on say, a torus, or accordingly, it has to hold for any state in the one sector. Okay, any excitation that I can create locally. Translation has to act on it in this way. So then I can say, well, what about the action of translation on a state containing two E particles? So that state would actually look something like this. So I've got an E particle localized here, another one localized here, and a string connecting them. So this one lives inside some region, this one lives inside another region, and each of these regions I can say is a region in the, you know, in the E super selection sector. Okay. So the crucial assumption that we need to make, which I can argue for in a second, is that acting on this kind of a state, the translation operator factorizes, okay, and it factorizes into a product of an operator TEX of 1, and TEX of 1 is an operator which has localized itself to this region. And same thing for this operator localized in this region. Okay. More formally, this operator has support only on this region, and same thing for this operator in this region. Okay. So why should it be possible to do that? Well, the idea is basically that the ground state here is some translation invariant background. Okay. And it should be possible to transform. One way to transform that state is just to move the whole thing over. But another way is to say, well, I have these excitations on top of this translation invariant background. I should be able to just move those excitations and accomplish that completely locally. Okay. And in various examples, one can actually accomplish this construction. And I'll tell you about that a little later at the end if there's time. Okay. But this assumption I'll call symmetry localization. Okay. So by the way, this is the crucial place where I'm ruling out the possibility that a symmetry would turn an E particle into an M particle. Okay. Because that cannot be accomplished by a local operator, by construction. You can't turn an E into an M locally. You need some non-local operation to do that. So by making this assumption, we're assuming that symmetries don't permute the anion types. Okay. Right, so there are examples where something else happens, but what I would claim is that the only examples that don't satisfy this assumption are examples where symmetry permutes the anion types. At least I don't know any example that falls outside of those two possibilities. All right. So once you do this, okay, then you can say, well, now acting on this 2E particle state, I'm going to compute this relation. I'll take a product of TXs and TYs in this way. I know this product has to equal 1 acting on this state. But now for every term in the product, I factorize it in this way. And so when I compute this product, I actually get two products, one associated with region 1, the other one associated with region 2. Okay, and those two square. And so what that tells me is that in general, this symmetry localization of translation, if I compute the group relation for that, I can get plus or minus 1. I'm allowed to get minus 1 now for the symmetry localized to a single E particle. Okay, and it has to be plus or minus 1. Well, really, because of the E cross E equals 1 fusion rule, right? In general, I could have said maybe it's an arbitrary phase, but these are the only two possibilities consistent with fusion. Okay, there's a nice simple physical interpretation of this, right? Because this translation just takes you around a plaquette once. And basically what you're saying here, if this is minus 1, the E particle picks up a phase of minus 1 when it went around this plaquette. So the E particles essentially can feel zero flux or pi flux on every elementary plaquette of the lattice. Okay, so that's fine. So the next thing that's important to say is that this phase, let me call it sigma E, this thing is a constant on the E superselection sector. So if it's plus 1 for one E particle, it has to be plus 1 for every single E particle in the spectrum. Okay, so what's the argument for that? Suppose that's not true, then I can find an E particle where this is plus 1 and another one where it's minus 1. And then I confuse them, and then I have a one-sector region, so an excitation that I should be able to create locally on which translation acts projectively. Okay, it TX and TY anti-commute acting on this region. Okay, and that's a contradiction. Okay, so we assume that's really part of the definition of our model. That's a contradiction. Okay, so therefore, this thing has to be constant on the E superselection sector. One thing you can say is that as long as the gap is open and you preserve the symmetry, the sectors stay well defined, and we can label states in the E superselection sector by this quantity, and states in the E superselection sector can only mix with one another. They can't mix with states outside that superselection sector because the sectors are not connected by any local operators. And so that means that as long as you keep the gap open and preserve the symmetry, this discrete quantity sigma E can't change. Okay, so it's a robust property of a Z2 spin liquid phase so long as you keep the translation symmetry and keep the gap open. Okay, so you can use this to label and distinguish different phases, right? You can't change it by some small symmetry preserving changes of parameters. Okay, so that's why you can use this kind of information to get a symmetry classification. Okay, so then I can ask, what is the classification if we just have translation symmetry? Well, I have to specify this phase factor for E, M, and epsilon. Okay, so so naively you might say there might be four ways to do this, right? I specify plus or minus one for E, plus or minus one for M. Plus or minus one for epsilon follows because I can always get an epsilon by taking an E and an M, putting them nearby, and drawing a bigger box around them. And so the phase factor for epsilon will just be a product of the E and M phase factors. Okay. So there are two Z2 parameters. Naively, there would be four choices, but two of them go into one another under relabeling E and M. So there are three classes, just like in the case of spin rotation. You'll see in a bit, actually, all of these classes are realized, can be realized in the toric code model if you play around with it a little bit. So one thing to point out, just to come back to an earlier point, this is not a classification of IREPs of the translation symmetry group, right? This is a coarser classification. It's really a classification of sort of different kinds of projective representations. Okay. So in order to understand what that means, it's necessary at this point to introduce some math. But what I like to say about this math is that we don't teach this in undergraduate quantum mechanics, but we could. And actually, we sort of do in a sense, because we always talk about spin a half and spin one. But we don't talk about it for discrete groups. But we could. It's really not that complicated. So just some math for a moment. Okay, so let's consider a symmetry group G, elements little g, and let's let gamma of G be some projective representation. So what it means for this to be a projective rep is that you take a product of two gammas, G1 and G2, you get gamma of G1 times G2, but only up to a phase. Okay, and that phase you can think of as a function of these two group elements. Okay, so this phase, you can think of this function of two group elements. Well, it's called a factor set. That's just terminology. And in this particular case, we want to consider factor sets that are plus or minus one valued. And that comes from the fusion rule, really. Okay, so we're describing projective representations that, so that comes from the fusion rule. I think maybe I have to come back to why that's true in a second. So this factor set is not a completely arbitrary function, but it satisfies an associativity constraint because you might want to multiply by another gamma of G, and then you can associate in two ways, and you have to get the same answer. So that gives you this equation. You can show that you can multiply two factor sets and get another one which satisfies the same associativity constraint. And so this just naive multiplication defines an abelian group structure on these factor sets. Okay, this abelian group structure, it's induced by taking a tensor product of two projective representations. Okay, and that's physically important because that tensor product corresponds to fusion of anion. So if you have two anions transforming under projective reps, you fuse them, that corresponds to taking a tensor product, and the factor set of the fused anion is this product. Okay, so that's kind of, you know, so one concrete thing you can say is you can get the factor set of epsilon by taking a product of the E and M factor sets. Okay, now there's some redundancy in this description, okay, and the point is that you can take these gamma of G's and you can make sort of a gauge transformation on them where you multiply them by some arbitrary plus or minus one valued function of group elements. So lambda also takes values in Z2. That doesn't affect any physics because if I have, you know, I always have states with say an even number of E particles, right? And so I might have gamma of G acting on this one and that one. And so I have a gamma of G over here and another gamma of G over here. And if I multiply those both by minus one, it doesn't do anything, right? So more concretely, right, if I multiply both of these T's by minus one, nothing happens to the state. So that means that I'm free to make these transformations without affecting any physics. These transformations induce this kind of transformation of the factor set. Okay. So what we say is, well, we don't really care about the factor sets except up to this kind of gauge equivalence. And so what we really want to do is classify factor sets up to gauge equivalence. Okay. And so that will give us some different classes of projective representations. All right. Not only do the factor sets form an abelian group, but the classes also form an abelian group. And that abelian group is called H2 of G, Z2. Okay, so this is one of the simplest groups that appear in group cohomology. Okay, but you don't ever need to say the words group cohomology. You can just say these words and say, I'm going to call that group this symbol. Okay, right. So. Right, so this math is simpler than group cohomology. That's the point. So these factor set classes, right? So what do I want to say? So coming back to physics, right? The fractionalization class for one super selection sector in this language corresponds to one of these classes of factor sets or one element of H2. And those classes have to be constant on a sector by the same kind of argument that I gave before, okay? Because if you had two classes that, if you had an E particle in one class and an E particle in another class, and you fuse them by and that corresponds to taking a tensor product, then you would get a one particle in a non-trivial class. The only way that you always get a trivial class when you fuse two E particles is if the E particles all share the same class. Okay, so the factor set classes are also constant on sectors, just like this plus or minus ones for the case of translation symmetry. Okay, so what we need to do in general is we need to specify this class for each non-trivial superselection sector for E, M, and epsilon. But then the epsilon is given as a product of the E and M classes, okay, because of this fusion rule. So then a couple of other statements. This is sort of a purely mathematical statement. This pair of classes can also be viewed as an element of this cohomology group. That's only for connoisseurs, I guess. One point that's important is that, remember, we have this E to M relabeling, right? So if you have a pair, omega E, omega M, and some other pair that's related to that by EM relabeling, those are not distinct symmetry classes. So you have to remember that there's this relabeling. That somewhat cuts down on the number of classes you can have. All right. Okay. So this is pretty much everything you can say, at least from the point of view of this kind of classification, if all you have are symmetries that don't move your anions large distances. So one thing that you might notice is that so far in all this discussion, I only talked about fusion rules. Braiding statistics never came in at all. Okay, and you might say, well, that's kind of strange because braiding statistics is an important part of the theory. Does it come in somewhere? Okay, and so the answer is that it comes in, but you need to consider some space group symmetries that move particles by large distances. Okay, so that's tricky because this notion of symmetry localization has to be modified when you want to talk about some kind of a point group operation, like, say, a reflection symmetry. So say this is an axis about which we reflect, x goes to minus x, okay? And suppose we have an initial state that looks like this. So we have an E particle here, E particle here, and well, I know that this E particle should go here under this reflection, right? And I know that I can accomplish that by doing something locally here, and doing something locally here, and connecting those two local things with a string. Okay, so the way that I can, so clearly I have to generalize symmetry localization in this situation. I cannot accomplish this just by acting with something locally here, right? I still want to have some factorization like this. So what I can do is I can say, well, let me define a larger region, which is a union of this and this disjoint region. Okay, so the sort of initial region and some target region. And I can say that the symmetry localization of this px operator to this e particle is an operator which is supported on the union of this region and some linear region connecting the two. And on that linear region, it's just an e string and nothing else. Okay, it's only allowed to be a string operator outside these two regions. And so that prevents it from sort of disturbing the system out here, because the system out here should be locally in the ground state. Okay. So then I can say, well, that's fine, because now, so now that I've defined some generalized notion of what symmetry localized operators are in this kind of a situation, I can still write things like this, and I can still compute group relations sort of localized to a single E particle out of these new but somewhat more complicated localized operators. Okay. Okay, so you can do that, you know, there are a few details for which you can talk to me later or read our paper. But
so those local operators do carry strings, carry half strings.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So this thing, PEX1, it would really be something local here, and a string connecting those two local things. In the simplest models, like in the toric code, it would only be a string.
It
would just be a string.
It
has to annihilate one and create another one somewhere far away. Yeah, so that's what these do. Right. Okay. So far still no braiding statistics is entering. Okay. The reason, by the way, that no braiding statistics enters yet is if I just talk about E particles, I could imagine more complicated situations where maybe this string crosses this string. But these two strings commute. They're the same type of string. Okay. So no braiding statistics will come in yet, and that's because the E particles are just self bosons. All right. Okay, so at this point, so I could have said all of this equally well, by the way, for m's and even for epsilons. Okay, you can do this construction for epsilons just as well, even though they're fermions. So you can say that, well, I can consider some symmetry group. And this is just sort of to give you a flavor of how one actually would do a calculation. Okay, so let's consider the square lattice space group. It can be generated by three generators, one translation, and two reflection symmetries, these two reflections. There's also Y translation, but you can get that by this product of the other generators. And just to torture ourselves, let's say that we also have time reversal and we also have spin rotation. Okay. So you can write down a bunch of relations among these generators, and I claim that these relations completely define the group. Okay, if I was just talking about ordinary group theory, I would have a 1 on the right-hand side of all of these relations. These relations just say that the spin rotations commute with the discrete generators. And it turns out, actually, these are not modified when we talk about projective representations. Acting on an anyon, all of these relations get modified to have some plus or minus one valued parameter on the right-hand side. Okay, just like for the case of translation, that appears right here. But now there are a lot of these plus or minus ones. There are 11 of them in total. Okay, so you can show that these 11 parameters are all independent, but you have to check that. What this tells you is that there are 2 to the 11 different fractionalization classes, or equivalently, this H2 of G comma Z2 is Z2 to the 11. Okay.
How to check that?
How to check that these are independent? Yeah. So there are two things you have to check. The first thing you have to check is that the generators you have are sufficient to give you the full multiplication table for the group. So that's pretty easy to do. So for example, for square lattice space group, you have some canonical form. So any element is a point group element times a translation. And you can check that these space group generators are enough to reduce any product into that form. Okay, so first you check that you have enough generating relations. Then the kind of thing you might worry about is maybe I have too many, right? You can always write down other relations which are true, but you cannot have an arbitrary number of these parameters. So the best way to check is just to observe that this group, Z2 to the 11, can be generated by just 11 elements. So if you can explicitly find a set of 11 representations, you know, which give you a generating set for this group, then you're done. So that's all you have to do. And so it turns out that in this case, you can do that only with two-dimensional representations. So you can do this just by playing around with Pauli matrices for an hour. Yeah. Yeah, it's not that hard, actually. Right, yeah, so that's the simplest way I know how to really check this for sure. Right. So this is what you get for each super selection sector, okay? But then there's a question that comes up, and this is sort of the interesting part of space group symmetry. This is where things get subtle, and this is probably the most technical part of what we did. I don't have time to explain it in detail, so let me just kind of give you a sketch of how it works. So the basic question at this point is, how do we determine the fermion fractionalization class from the other two? Okay, so naively, so before we said that this is just a product of the other two classes, but now actually this product gets modified. Okay, there's some other factor set that appears in this product, omega t, which I call a twisting of this H2 group product. Okay, so you don't anymore just take the H2 product of the E and M classes, you have to modify that. Okay, and that modification is exactly manifestation of Braiding statistics. Okay, so how do you actually do this? How do you establish that this is true? The idea is you say, well, I can view these epsilons as composites of E's and M's. So I can always think about an epsilon this way. I have an E and an M, and the M is a cross here, and I draw a box around it. And then I can move these by drawing pairs of strings. And as you do this, so you can try to compute some group relation using these strings. Okay, and there are a whole bunch of different kinds of statistical phase factors that you have to keep track of as you do this. Okay, and the claim is that these phase factors can be associated with either this epsilon or this epsilon. There are no phase factors that come from any kind of statistical interaction between the two, it turns out. Okay, and so that makes life easier. And so you can keep track of all the phase factors associated with this one. You can keep track of all the phase factors associated with this one. And the conclusion is that some of the group relations get modified, actually just one. So the simplest way to explain it is, this is a relation that says that if, you know, px times pxy is a C4 rotation in the square lattice. So that thing to the fourth is one. So if that thing is sigma e for the e particle and sigma m for the m particle, what you can show by this, these kind of considerations here is that for the epsilon, it's minus sigma e sigma m. So you get a minus sign. And that minus sign is exactly coming from the mutual statistics of e and m.
That sounds like you showed this. The spin must be one. I mean, this the spatial spin has to be, orbital spin has to be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think in some sense, right. Right. The thing that surprises me about that, and I think I'd like to have a better understanding of this, is when we first got this result, I had a hard time believing it because I thought, look, we have discrete rotation. For continuous rotation symmetry, it kind of makes sense because you sort of know if you go all the way around. But for discrete rotation symmetry, you know, doing, how do you know that you did this and went around, or how do you distinguish that from this, where you don't actually make a cycle? And so for a while I had a hard time believing this result, you know, but sort of after doing it over and over again and sort of more and more carefully, you know, in the end, I convinced myself that this is unavoidable. But it's still a little surprising to me that it seems to be unavoidable for discrete rotation symmetry. So I would say that we have a technical understanding of this, not a very good intuitive understanding. And so there's probably room to improve on our result. Maybe we're wrong, actually, although I don't think so, by coming up with sort of a more intuitive understanding of this apparent
effect. I think effect. If epsilon E, epsilon M are both equal to 1, you can think of this like a 2-pi rotation. It's
Radio
1, that means integers, natural speed.
Yeah.
But then somehow when you combine the two, get together fermion.
Yeah.
Then you get an extra minus one. It's
right.
Like a 2-pi rotation.
Yeah, I think that's sort of a discrete rotation manifestation of that fact. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so none of the other relations are modified. Okay. So we're almost out of time, but I want to just tell you a little bit about what we're doing now. Okay. So one question that comes up is can you actually find models that realize any or all or some of these symmetry classes? Okay. And so that turns out to be an interesting question to ask for a variety of reasons. So the first thing that we did is just to study the toric code. Okay, so the toric code is a sum of some vertex and plaquette terms. And what you can do is you can play with the sign of the vertex and plaquette terms. Okay, so I don't have time to explain this in detail. But the point is the toric code has these two terms. You can play with their signs. Usually U and K in this way of writing it are chosen to be positive, but you don't need that. Model is still perfectly well defined and has the same topological order and is still exactly solvable no matter what you do with U and K. What you can do in this model, you can explicitly construct the symmetry localized operators for all the space group symmetries. And I'll tell you just a sort of a 1-minute version of how that works in a second. If you do that with just square lattice space group symmetry, you get this class for the E particle and this class for the M particle. So here I've chosen U and K to take values in plus or minus 1 just to simplify the notation. You can see that changing K changes the class of the E particle because this is like a flux for E particles. And changing U changes the class of M because U is kind of like a background gauge charge and the M particles pick up a minus sign when they move around a background gauge charge. Okay. So sorry that went fast, but I need to finish in a couple minutes, I think. So how do we actually construct symmetry localized operators in the toric code? Well, the point is that you can write down an initial state of two E particles. So you start with the ground state, and then you just take a product of sigma Z Pauli matrices on these red links, and that puts an E particle here and here. And so if you want to translate that, well, you just move this thing over, right? You know how to translate it. But you can also translate it by acting with a little bit of string, moving this one space to the right, and act with a little bit of string here that moves this one space to the right. Now, this state is not exactly the same as this, because the string also has to get shifted over. And you might accumulate some phase factor when you do that. Okay, and so you can write an expression for that phase factor, and you can show that this expression for the symmetry localization of Tx always works. It's just sigma z moving to the right by one space times some phase factor. Okay, so you can do this kind of explicit construction for all of the space group operations. Yeah, question.
Why do you say the state is not the same? Because I thought that the string is invisible.
So the state is the same up to a phase. The state is the same up to a phase. But you can accumulate phases by moving the strings around.
But it's an overall phase.
It's an overall phase. Okay. But those phases are actually kind of important. Because the fact that the string picks up, so if you look at this generalized version of the toric code, the thing that distinguishes these four different ground states is really E and M strings picking up phases as they move around. And so these symmetry classes, really what they physically correspond to are some patterns of phases that the anyon strings pick up as they move around. Okay, so that's at least for the space group symmetry, the symmetry class kind of, I think physically that's what it is. It is some kind of pattern of phase factors that the strings pick up as they move around. It's important. It's very important to keep track of that kind of information. In the end, actually, this phase winds up not mattering for any of the group relations. At least in the translation relation, it cancels out. But it's important at least to keep track of it as an intermediate step.
do you have to have a canonical arrangement of the string? For example, if you create a particle at a particular coordinate, the string of this part has to be have some patterns, so like you go through x link first, then go to y link second.
So you don't have to. So this doesn't depend on that. And the reason is that what you would say is if, so this, you could say, this looks like maybe I have to use this kind of canonical arrangement.
Yeah.
But suppose I distort this by adding a bit of string here, right? Then I have to distort the translated one by adding the same bit of string. And so those two things will cancel one another in the definition of the string vector. Yeah, so you don't need to, that's a nice thing. You don't need to specify the arrangement of the string in calculating these phase factors. That's good because it would make it a lot more complicated if you had to specify that. Yeah. Okay, so that realizes four classes, but then, you know, there's sort of a bigger question, which is, can we realize all the classes, right? So in fact, for space group symmetry, if you just have space group symmetry, you can count and it turns out there are 2,080 classes. Okay, so you can ask, can you find 2,080 different models that realize all the classes? And I think the answer, I don't completely know the answer to this question, but I think the answer is probably not. At least not if you have models that are strictly two-dimensional. And the reason is that for internal symmetry, like say time reversal, there are actually explicit examples of symmetry classes that can occur only on the boundary of a three-dimensional SPT state. Okay, and that means that it can't occur strictly in two dimensions. And so that means that some of the classes, at least in that case, of internal symmetries cannot occur strictly in 2D. They can only occur on the boundary of some non-trivial 3D bulk. Okay, and so that also suggests that for space group symmetry, now SPT phases for space group symmetry maybe are less interesting, but what is interesting is to think about what kinds of quantum number fractionalization are possible for space group symmetry strictly in two dimensions. Okay, so there's a question of which classes can we realize strictly in 2D. Okay, so a hard thing to do is to get a general understanding of this question. I have some ideas that maybe can lead to a general understanding of this question. But in the meantime, you can take a more empirical approach. You can say, can I construct models to realize as many of these classes as I can? And a good thing to do is to focus on a simple class of models where you can make general statements. Okay. So one thing you can say is, let's consider the toric code. You can define it on an arbitrary graph, okay, any graph at all. So we can define it on an almost arbitrary 2D lattice. So 2D lattice, so what I mean by almost arbitrary 2D lattice is that it's a set of points in the two-dimensional plane. So those are the vertices, and the vertices are connected by links, and the links are allowed to cross one another. Okay, so it's not a planar graph in general. But the vertices are not allowed to stack. That's just for simplicity. A completely general 2D lattice would also allow stacking of vertices. Okay, so, and we can consider that case too, we just haven't done it yet. So we also assume that if you have a symmetry S, it maps links of this lattice into some other link, and there's no spin orbit coupling. So that symmetry does nothing within the two component Hilbert space of each link. Okay, that's just a simplifying assumption. So we could relax that. With these assumptions, it's possible to show that most of these 2,080 symmetry classes are impossible. Okay, and there are only 82 that we cannot rule out, and we actually have an explicit model realizing all these 82. Okay, so just to give an idea, you know, so this model, for example, can realize any of the fractionalization classes for the E particle. So that in the E sector, you can do anything you like, but keeping always the M sector trivial. So that actually gives you 64 out of these 82 classes.
You mean only one or all three?
What do you mean all three?
You see this model, I mean, you have one model?
This is one model. These are three pictures of the same model.
Oh,
so this is the toric, this, so these black dots are vertices. They form octagons. Then you so this is kind of a, the way to think about this is a decorated version of the square octagon lattice. Okay, so I have octagons and squares. My translation symmetry is this and this. So I could have a larger symmetry like from here to here, but let's say we don't have that. And then instead of just a straight line link between any two vertices, I have these figure eight things. So I have one blue link and one red link, and they cross here, but there's no vertex at the crossing. Okay. And this is a picture of just the blue links, and this is a picture of just the red links. And it turns out that there are 6 independent loops on which you can have fluxes on this lattice. And that gives you 6 Z2 parameters. And if you vary those 6 parameters, you get all 2^6 fractionalization classes for the E particle. Okay. But the M fractionalization class is trivial, actually, in all these examples. Okay. You're not, one's just not doing anything with that. Okay, so I don't have time to explain this. You can ask me later if you're curious how this goes. So you can make general arguments to show that within this class of models, only 82 symmetry classes are possible. Okay, so there are actually only 18, not very many, where both the E and the M particle have a non-trivial class. So those are kind of rare. And you can find, if you're Hao Song, you can find lattice models that actually realize all of these 82 classes. And so these are some examples, pretty pictures. Okay. So we have some understanding of what classes can be realized, but it's limited to this class of models so far. We don't have a complete understanding yet. Okay. I already mentioned some open issues. I said that, you know, it would be nice to obtain a general understanding of what symmetry classes can really be realized in 2D. There are various obvious generalizations one can attempt of this work. One thing you could do is try to generalize this to other topological orders, not just Z2 topological order. And at least if you restrict to the case of no point group symmetry, for any abelian topological order, this is trivial. It's actually quite easy to do. I can explain it if you're interested. If you include point group symmetry, I'm not completely sure I know how to do this, even for general abelian topological order. One can also imagine trying to include interchanges of E and M. There could be some pretty interesting physics in going to 3 dimensions. The thing that I think could be quite interesting in 3D is if you have you can have an Ising-Gauge theory in 3D which has point fractionalized particles, and so the E particles kind of remain points when you go to 3D, but the M particles become line objects. And there's a statistical interaction where if you bring an E around an M line, you get a -1. Okay. So the E particles are kind of, they're point-like objects, and the same kind of story probably applies in 3+1 dimensions. But the question is, what about these M lines, right? But there are Z2 gauge theories in 3D with background charge where the M lines pick up phases as they move around, okay? That has something to do with space group symmetry. So I think there should be some kind of classification of kind of fractionalization for these M lines. And I can kind of wildly speculate that this might have something, this might be connected to edge states of 2D SPT phases. The reason is that these M lines you can think of as the boundary of a 2D surface, which has no surface tension and which is fluctuating wildly. And so there's some connection there to the edge states of a 2D SPT phase, but of course there the two-dimensional bulk is fixed. It's not a fluctuating object. So I think there might be something interesting there. And another really interesting question is to think about how to detect this information in a numerical simulation. So for example, if somebody hands you a ground state wave function or a set of degenerate ground state wave functions, is there something you can do with those ground state wave functions to tell which symmetry class you're in, right? Maybe you, in principle, you probably ought to be able to do that without even looking at the excitations, even if you don't have access to the excitations. But I don't know how to do that yet. But that could be a question of some real practical relevance, because it, you know, in the end, one could try to apply that to, you know, some of the numerical studies of these Kagame and J1, J2 Heisenberg models. Okay. One can also ask about experimental signatures, but right now there's not really a good candidate material for a gap Z2 spin liquid that I know of. And so it's kind of interesting to think about this question, but probably the numerics question is more pressing at the moment. Okay, thanks.
Question. change part, can you talk a bit more about that? Why is it so hard to do that?
I don't think it's necessarily, okay, right. So the question is, what about this interchange of E and F?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't think it's necessarily hard. So, and I even have a conjecture for how to think about it. I've just never really sat down and thought through it very carefully. The other thing that's probably true is that you probably get a lot of possibilities which cannot be realized in strictly 2D. Like, so I think there is probably some general algebraic theory of E and M interchange. So the kinds of things, so what can you do, right? So any symmetry operation, it can either it interchanges E and M or it doesn't. Okay. So more mathematically, there has to be a homomorphism from the symmetry group to Z2, where the elements that map to the non-trivial element of Z2 are the ones that do interchange, and the ones that map to the identity don't interchange. Okay, so that's one piece of information that you can specify. So now there's the subgroup of the symmetry group that doesn't interchange. There will be some subgroup H that doesn't interchange. For that subgroup, you can talk about factor sets and fractionalization for E and M in the same way that I did here, at least on that subgroup. And for the whole symmetry group, you can talk about the same thing for epsilon, because epsilon can never get exchanged with anything else. Okay. So those are a bunch of pieces of information. And even if you just specify those pieces of information, you can see there are certain consistency relations that have to be obeyed. Actually, among, so like there are, you know, four pieces of information. So what interchanges, what doesn't, the epsilon fractionalization class and the ENM fractionalization classes on this restricted subgroup. So on the restricted subgroup, EM and epsilon still have to agree and obey this kind of product relation. Okay, so my conjecture is that maybe that's everything, that specifying all that information is all there is to specify. Okay. I'm not completely sure if that's true or not, but that's some conjecture.
And physically, how do you realize these symmetries? I mean, you know, an example of.
So there's a model. Let me write it here. So there's a model. So it's Xiaogang's model. It's called Wen-Plaquette model. But I usually like to explain it as just the toric code, but a toric code where the vertex and plaquette terms have the same coefficient. Okay, so in that model, you have an extra translation symmetry. Okay, you can sort of do half translations where you can do this kind of diagonal translation. And what you see is that under this diagonal translation, this vertices and plaquettes get exchanged. Okay, you can only do this if U and K are equal, right? The two terms have to be the same. But the point is that since the E particles live on a vertex and the M particles live on a plaquette, you can exchange E and M particles with this symmetry. So this is the simplest example I know where that actually happens. And you can see that you can't accomplish this. If you think about it a little more, there's no way to accomplish this locally. The way you would accomplish this is something like, if I've got an E here and an E here, so let's call this, right? So I have E's here connected by a string. I want to translate that to a couple of M's. In order to do that, you basically have to act with the string here that destroys these two E's and act with another string here that creates these two M's. So you can only do this in some non-local fashion. So for this kind of thing, you can see very explicitly in this model that symmetry localization fails.
Maybe a comment about this experimental detection.
Yeah.
I think for the translation, this the TXTY have minor sign.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah.
There is a way to detect in a sense, say the neutron scan.
Yeah. Right. In fact, I even said this when I gave this talk in Santa Barbara. But yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So right. So
other yeah. Time we may have something similar. There's some extra pure.
Yeah. I agree with that. Right. So it's right. So I don't want to give the impression that it's sort of hopeless to think about experimental signatures, because I don't think that's true. So what Xiaogang is saying is that you know, suppose you have an E particle which is spin a half, okay, and which also has TX and TY anti-commuting, okay? So then what you can imagine is, suppose you do neutron scattering, you can't probe the E particle directly, but you can probe the bottom edge of a spin one continuum, right? So you, and suppose that you get lucky, and suppose that that bottom edge really corresponds to scattering states of those two spin a half E particles. For that, you have to get sort of lucky, but let's suppose you get lucky. So if that's true, what you can show is that the bottom edge of that continuum is actually in every quadrant of the Brillouin zone, it has to be identical. So it has sort of an extra periodicity by pi zero and zero pi, which would not be there normally. And so if anybody ever saw that, that would be, you know, will be really striking, pretty remarkable signature of, you know, this kind of quantum number fractionalization. And it's probably possible, that's for the case where you only have translation symmetry, but if you have more symmetry, you can presumably say more about, you know, what the bottom edge of that continuum looks like.
I wonder whether there's a phone not happening missing.
I've done some studies for phones for this drug spinning, but I actually didn't go to Z2, so that's in principle interesting.
One kind of, you know, idle speculation about this sort of thing is that, you know, I wonder if it's possible to generalize that statement, at least to a certain extent, even to gapless spin liquids, right? Because in gapless spin liquids, you can also have some degrees of freedom within in which you formulate the theory which transform projectively. And you can also have a, you know, they can be spin a half, you can have a similar continuum, but maybe it's gapless at some points. You know, it's possible that there could be some kind of signature in the shape of the bottom of that continuum.
More interesting if this degree of freedom actually is not well defined deposit particle.
Right. Yeah.
We still have this signature.
Yeah, that's right.
One more question. Let's thank Mike again.